Hey, everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. Happy New Year to all of our listeners, old and new. For those of you new to us, welcome to the pod. This is where we discuss items from the ASAP Now magazine and online with more in-depth features with our authors, or have some special content for the podcast only that broadly touches on all parts of emergency medicine that we may not always have room for in the formal ASAP Now publication. 2025 will hopefully be a great year for all of us. The practice of emergency medicine is ever changing, and I think we all feel the shifts in the market in terms of what is the structure of the practice of emergency medicine beyond the clinical updates that we know will come throughout the year. Now, as they say, new year, new you, and maybe a new job for some of you. So I thought this was a great month to feature one of our ASAP Now authors, Dr. Vukmir, to talk about emergency physician contracts and what to look for, what to negotiate, and what to understand before you sign. As the business of emergency medicine changes, my opinion is now that the contract matters more than ever. Hopefully, you will never have an issue where you have to refer back to it. But in this day and age with NES, APP, Envision, and so on, it is never safe to say never. So check it out. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, and thanks again for joining me here at ASAP Nowcast. We have a really special guest here today to feature an article called Employment Contracts. It's all in the details. So as you can imagine, it is about employment contracts and the details that we should look for as emergency physicians, which I found to be a really timely thing to consider, especially given some of the changes going on in the market today. So we have with us today Dr. Roddy Vukmir, who is actually an MD-JD and also a professor of clinical emergency medicine at Drexel University. Dr. Vukmir, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
And certainly appreciate the kind introduction as well as the opportunity to discuss. Again, as stated, I do have a degree in law, specifically directed at healthcare law, and have spent a significant amount of time in the professional liability malpractice space, and have brought that experience as well as a contract negotiation discussions and publications in this area.
And that's actually what I found so helpful. Like, not only are you a physician who obviously has your own employment contracts, but you have the background that tells us what is the expertise we should look for when evaluating a new job. And I thought actually your introduction in this article was perfect. You said, although most emergency doctors focus primarily on money paid and hours worked, career quality and longevity are optimized by good contract negotiation. So I wanted to jump in with you giving us a summary for the listeners of what are the most important contract provisions to consider.
Sure. And again, as we all recognize, it's in the details. That's what matters. And remember, on the front end of this, it's pleasant. There's a big recruiting push. It's a pretty positive feedback cycle for all involved. But at some point in the lifetime of that employment relationship, then things can actually occur. And then people take a lot closer look at the document itself and then find out that there may be issues that weren't truly appreciated on the front end. I think the important considerations that I've tried to suggest here are that, again, obviously the focus on kind of time and financial effort, but I think the important part of that process, is to recognize, as you've questioned here, is there compensation for additional work? Is that work defined in some reasonable fashion? One of the quality of life indicators, as we know, is, are you getting out on time? Or are you staying, an extra hour or two every day for documentation or for clinical overrun? Part of emergency medicine, I think we all are in it for the same reasons. And, we're patient care focused and we want to help our peers and the staff. But, we want to make sure that, what you've signed up for is really what's been delivered. So, again, if there is a reasonable expectation of a little bit of work every day that's over and above your assigned hours, then that's fine. But if it becomes persistent, you know, it definitely contributes to burnout. And secondarily, if it becomes persistent, it should be compensated for. And these are questions that you ask on the front end. You know, what's the extra time commitment and will I be compensated for it? It's better to discuss it on the front end than the back end.
Now, specifically on that, you know, uncompensated work discussion, like there's just so much. Like there's maintaining your license, there's credentialing, there's the re-credentialing, there's, you know, all the CME we have to do, chart completion, signing APP charts, et cetera. Like, how hard do you detail this? Because in my head, I'm thinking really of the new grad coming out of residency who's saying, you know, thank God I have a contract, let me sign now. Like, and they get really worried. I think all of us get really worried about negotiating it too hard. Like, what's your suggestion here?
Right. And, you know, and I've made that recommendation before in a previous ASAP vehicle, which is you probably have the right to negotiate one or two hard points, but much past that, you know, handing the contract to some attorney reviewer that then comes back with a 75% red line version, you know, no one's really interested in that, to be quite honest, on either side. So I feel like you should decide the one or two points that are really important for you, life-changing events, and I would put those on the table. Now, obviously, if you're in a competitive environment where there are a lot of applicants for very few jobs, you tend to see this in the big academic environments when, you know, every year there's a new crop of candidates. You know, your bargaining power is less. If, on the other hand, you're going to be doing rural emergency medicine in some distant state, you know, you probably have more bargaining power in that position. So I feel like just sort of knowing where you are, knowing what the negotiation balance is, I think that's really important going into the contract itself.
Now, I think that's a really good point, is like, don't negotiate everything. Pick the couple things that might be important to you. And you actually talk about this in an article, but non-compete. So I think a lot of ER doctors do choose jobs based on location, like they have family ties or their spouse has a job, et cetera. There's been a lot of action on non-competes with the FTC, and contracts are obviously a little bit all over the place regarding non-competes. I would just love to get your thoughts on this topic. Like, what should doctors look for? What's the current, you know, legal or just contract climate regarding this topic? How enforceable it is? Is it just any thoughts you have here?
Sure. Let's do a discussion that, you know, what was then and what is now. And, you know, prior to this publication, I sort of thought long and hard about how to modify this based on the first quarter FTC ruling. And as with a lot of sort of legal interventions, you know, it has to be what we would call settled law. And so now, working backwards from the FTC intervention, they said, well, you know, here's this list of things, and we're gonna intervene here and say that this part of, you know, practice is not allowed. It wasn't really focused on high-end professionals. And so there were some exclusions there, which were, one, if you have a largely administrative practice, then this didn't apply to you. Number two, if you made over a certain salary amount, I think at the time it was like 151K, then this doesn't necessarily apply to you. And third, when you look at these employment law issues that are done on a legislative basis, you know, physicians are not often felt to be an aggrieved party, so to speak, right? That's not what these things are focused on. And so at the end of the day, very quickly, there were two states that challenged this decision, both Texas and Florida. For different reasons, they basically said that this was not allowed, and that was upheld at a federal judicial appeals level. So at this point, it's sort of back to where we started. Realize that there are a lot of powerful forces on both sides of this. So honestly, before you think that this is sunsetted, you have to recognize that it's probably more complicated than it appears. So now let's take a step back at what reasonable recommendations are here. if you're going to sign a non-compete, recognize a lot of this decision-making is state-based. Is it a sort of a right-to-work state? Number two, is it reasonable in scope? So if something's for a one-year period and it's got a reasonable geographic radius and it's only specific to that practice and not every type of practice that you do, then it probably would have been upheld in the old days. And now with this change, it's still likely to be challenged. Could the physician prevail in a challenge? The answer is yes, but who has the time, interest, effort, finances to, you know, to battle this out with a large entity? You know, it's just not productive. And so at the end of the day, we still have this concept in negotiation process. I would bring up the fact that it's been excluded, and then see what the response is. Some vendors might say, okay, let's take it out. Others may say, well, you know, we really have, you know, operational trade secrets. We've really invested a lot in you recruitment wise and financially. So I think it's good to be part of the dialogue to see what the response is, but don't expect that it'll be wiped clean from the slate, because that's just not the nature of this kind of legal back and forth.
And it's helpful because this topic to me is something where it doesn't hurt to ask. Like negotiating a rate, like, you know, it doesn't really hurt to ask either, but like, you know, that might exclude you. In this case, I feel like it's not the doctor that you're working with or the site medical director. It's like they have to escalate to their legal. So I do like, you know, the idea that this is a convoluted space right now. So you can always ask, especially with something that's important to you.
Right. And you bring up another valid point, you know, especially when you're working with a larger institution, you know, it's sort of a take it or leave it strategy. You know, they're not prone to, you know, they have a physician contract, and that, you know, whether you're doing pathology or emergency medicine, that's the one they give you. So like I said, you can maybe negotiate one or two points, but not much more than that. Again, they use a templated professional service contract for their physician employees.
Yep, absolutely. Now you talk about a couple other broad pieces in the article, including due process and force majeure. And, you know, I wanted the listeners to certainly go read about it, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention the concept of malpractice, especially malpractice tail, with, you know, NES, APP, I guess technically Envision, although they just restructured. Like, we saw at least two major groups go out of business and leave their emergency physicians largely without a liability tail. So I would love to hear your thoughts here. I think this is something that potentially became more important as the market has changed with the various emergency medicine groups. So what are the things you would tell a doc to look for here?
Yeah, it is unfortunate. You know, I spent a decent amount of my career in sort of, you know, a contract management space. And this was always the kind of the concerning specter, was that whether a group would go out of business and have never banked the money for this tail. And so towards the end of the professional liability process in emergency medicine, you know, there were essentially no occurrence-based professional liability policies. You know, the group that I was with at the time, we did offer an occurrence-based policy. It cost more money, but, you know, that basically insured you now, and it insured you in the future without a claims-made portion, which is something happening now, plus a tail for coverage later. So the occurrence-based policy literally left the industry. It was no longer available. And so that's, you know, that's the nature of that product. So unfortunately, if there's an exit market for a small group, moderate-sized group, and in this case, larger groups that underwent a bankruptcy process, you know, the provider, it's really a difficult situation, because if you're negotiating the cost of an insurance product, the cost for an individual physician versus a group product, they're vastly discrepant. So I feel like the only thing that we could probably try and suggest and help is that somehow if you know, the emergency medicine community could create a, you know, a sort of group model for this exit tail deficiency, I think that would help. Would you have to pay for it? The answer is yes, but your rates tend to be better in a group model than an individual model.
Yeah, and especially as these groups are, you know, exiting the market, it leaves a lot of physicians together that potentially could open up, you know. I feel like there's a collaboration, right, for this group model instead of the individual. Is that somewhat accurate?
Right. And again, I feel that, you know, I guess the point is that really if you're negotiating this cost, you know, there's a benefit for the insurer to, you know, engage more providers for a scalable cost than per individual. So I guess what I would recommend is if physicians are in this situation, to try and see if they can somehow get themselves into a group model that would allow them to pay a lower cost for the insurance, but, you know, sort of going bare here, so to speak, without insurance, you know, that is certainly risky. You know, the tail off process for professional liability is, you know, 5 to 7 years typically from start to finish. So, you know, there's a pretty long kind of runoff period.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's worth mentioning that ASEP and, you know, both APP and NES has offered a lot of resources for the physicians affected. So that's something to look at if you are in that bucket. Now, Dr. Buchmeier, this has been really helpful. I know in your article, you recommend having someone review a contract and, you know, maybe an attorney with background, maybe someone like you. Like, I would love to have you know, in my pocket for every ER doctor that wants a contract reviewed. That's obviously not realistic. What would you recommend for an ER doctor who maybe just doesn't know anyone that's like a contract expert? Like, what would you recommend them do? Like, do they just Google healthcare attorney ER, or like, what should they do to try to find someone to point out some of these salient nuances for them?
Well, let me give you a couple of staged answer there. I think, you know, at the juxtaposition of this question and the last, one of the things that ASEP does offer is that the medical legal committee, you know, I've chaired that in the past, and, you know, we currently have an active plan to, you know, to assist providers and physicians in their kind of in their questions. So we tend to reserve that a little bit more for a complicated situation. You know, we don't just do contract review, but you can contact ASEP and then we will, you know, sort of get you aligned with someone on the medical legal committee that, you know, typically has got a world of experience. And so we do want to make that offer out, you know, as you suggested, you know, ASEP does a lot of directed support here for our physicians. And that is one of the ways to do that. Now, in answer to the question next layer, which is, how do you get your individual contract reviewed? You know, this is a little bit complicated. If you retain an attorney, and it often is a good idea to do so. I really do think it's a good idea, especially in complicated situations. It's a really important decision. Then you would want to find someone that does physician professional liability or physician personal service contracting. And so that individual tends to look at more of these contracts. You tend to build up a knowledge base of what's equivalent from place to place and what's offered. And I think you want to certainly find someone that works in this physician personal service contract area. Is it hard to find? Yes. You start searching around the internet. You know, they sort of funnel a lot of this work to them, but then at the end you find out that that's not really what they do. So certainly personal recommendations are helpful. Again, contacting ASEP for additional information. But I think it's always a good idea to have a 1 hour contract review. It's definitely worth the upfront investment.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, especially as you're going into hopefully a several year contract and, you know, agreement with the group, like hopefully, fingers crossed. Now, lastly, I know, you know, the article is limited on word count, and of course, we're limited on time. So I still encourage all of our listeners to check it out on ASEP Now. It's called Employment Contract. It's all in the details. But as a close, any other thoughts that you have about contract items to look for that just didn't make it into the article? Like, I would love for you to just throw out any additional nuance because it might, you know, ring the ear of someone where that is important to them.
Sure. I would like to emphasize one other point, which was sort of a quirky curiosity known as the force majeure contract provision. It was never activated ever. And then during COVID, there were a lot of changes made. So basically what happened was there were financial changes that occurred and there were physicians that were no longer employed. So the ability for a company to say, look, there are things that are beyond our control that would make this contract invalid. Those were reasonable, legitimate concerns. The one caveat is that if the company made a decision that just said, look, this is a losing line of business for us, we're going to just get out of this, it didn't alleviate that financial responsibility, right? So if somebody reorgs as Chapter 11, you know, allowing reorganization, then, you know, it couldn't have been a business decision. You know, Chapter 7, you go bankrupt, you know, there's a court-appointed sort of, you know, administrator. That's a little bit of a different situation. So I think it's important to note that. Now, why is that important now? Well, because of the reasons that you stated before with NES, APS, and you know, looking at some of these transitions, you have to be careful and look at the financial transition. Was it all or none and catastrophic? You know, you probably don't have a lot of information or a lot of good position there versus a reorganization where your position is probably a little bit stronger. In regards to the only other thing that I would offer about sort of contract negotiation, again, the most important part of this is, again, you know, physicians, especially, you know, certainly on that first contract and, you know, early in contracting, you know, you want to be a good corporate citizen. You know, you want to, you know, you're transitioning early in your practice. And so you want to make sure that you put a positive kind of face on this and that you're, you know, here to work and you're getting to do your dream occupation. And I think that's important. As time goes on, again, you just want to be sure that there's an equivalency of the process, that for the work and the investment that you've made in the organization, they would really do the same with you. And as time goes on, things like work-life balance, you know, making sure that you've got good career longevity. You know, I often put emergency medicine, it's one of the acute care specialties. And you know, again, my areas of interest are emergency medicine, critical care, and neurocritical care. You know, these sort of acute care disciplines are, you know, are probably 30-year careers, you know, 0 to 10 early, 10 to 20 mid, and, you know, 20 to 30 late. Now, you know, we have physicians in emergency medicine that have worked for 50 years. So I think the goal here is to make sure that it's not just about the money, but it's about the quality of the work that you provide. You know, is the corporate environment a good fit for you with your goals and objectives? You know, are you a good sort of corporate citizen or are you a good world citizen? I think that's really the important part of this over time. And, you know, if I had to say one recommendation is, you know, just make sure that it's a good fit and that their needs and your needs are pretty well aligned.
Yeah, absolutely. I think now we are feeling that the market is a little bit less stable than it was. And, you know, I've personally been lucky enough to be at the same group for the past 8 years. So I haven't had to go through this rodeo. But when I, you know, talk to residents, for sure, I tell them, like, what is the stability of their group you're signing on with? Do you feel like you respect them and they respect you in turn? Because those are things that will keep you there. And, you know, goodness knows it's hard enough to learn a new system or go through another contract negotiation or recredential, et cetera. So the ideal is hopefully you don't have to do it too often. Well, Dr. Vukmir, I want to say thank you again so much for taking the time. You are a wealth of knowledge on this topic. I absolutely love the article, and I think it will do a lot of good for our listeners and readers. So thanks again.
And again, really appreciate your interest and the opportunity to have this discussion with our group.
We could all use a Dr. Vukmir in our lives to help review our next contracts, but since he can't be everywhere for everyone, check out his article again in ASAP Now. Now, there's tons more in ASAP Now this month for you. There's more on the practice of emergency medicine, including resident unionization and their almost strike at George Washington, and a discussion on state legislation to mandate an emergency physician in every emergency department. Like always, we have also plenty of clinical pearls. We have Dr. Hellman with post-tonsillectomy hemorrhage, which is one of my most nerve-wracking personal cases recently. We have Dr. Restifer with inhaled steroids in asthmatics, and Dr. White with pregnant cardiovascular disease. So that is it for us this month on January's ASAP Nowcast. But as always, tweet us if you have an idea at ASAP Now, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks, you guys, and we'll see you all next time.